We're at the Estancia Hotel and Spa, just down the street from the Salk Institute, where the 8th stem cell meeting on the Mesa has just been held. And one of the panels was on tracking stem cells using in vivo imaging. The moderator, the person who set up the panel, and somebody recently joined UC San Diego is Eric Ahrens, who's professor of radiology and director of stem cell molecular imaging there at UC San Diego. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's do a quick summary of where this all is for a lay audience, the whole imaging of stem cells and so on and so forth. Can you provide a context for this?
My perspective is that in the future, people will want to know where cells go in the body when they're put in for therapeutic purposes. And this is important for primarily two reasons. One is for scientific reasons. The migration of cells and their behavior in the body tells you about the modes of action. And you want to understand things like the persistence of the cells. Do they reside in the place that you put them? Do they migrate away from the site of injection days and weeks later? Do they go someplace that you weren't aware of? Is there a cellular niche that was not known before? These are important things to know when understanding the behavior of cells. So I think that the ability to track cells in the body using non-invasive imaging is what I've been developing. And my approach to doing this is to use magnetic resonance imaging. Mm-hmm. And historically, MRI is thought of as a diagnostic tool, a clinical diagnostic tool. It's used to diagnose soft tissue lesions, and it's very good at that. MRI has the fantastic ability to image the body, particularly soft tissues, using intrinsic contrast mechanisms. So you don't have to put a pharmaceutical agent into the body to actually see where the lesions are. Intrinsic contrast from the tissue can actually display itself and show you the lesions in with exquisite detail. What we're trying to do, though, is adapt MRI. What my research is basically focused on is adapting MRI to visualize cells in the body and also molecular events. And so in order to give MRI that ability, we have to develop new classes and categories of molecules and reagents that impart exogenous contrast to cells in the body. And so that's been a lot of what my research has been focused on, developing those agents and characterizing their effects on cells that have been labeled, and then applying these to important biological questions.
Hmm. Now, are we talking about dynamic or static?
Well, the beauty of MRI is that you can do longitudinal studies, so that mm-hmm. enables dynamic visualization of biological processes. Yeah. And cells, many cell types are itinerant, and so you'd like to be able to see their movements from moment to moment. And this gives you a rich data set. And so the tools for that are just being developed now. And so I think this is a fruitful area. It's a genuinely a new use for MRI. It's basically adapting MRI to visualize biological processes rather than diagnose clinical conditions. And so that's pretty much what my career has been focused on for about the last 20 years or so.
Where did it start?
I came into science as a physicist. That's where my formal training is in college. It's undergraduate degrees.
But go back even before that. I mean, why science? I mean, was there something prompted you to think?
Yeah, my family background is rather scientific. My father was a professor, and he was a professor for many years at Caltech, and he was interested in geophysics, planetary science. And so I think that although I wasn't particularly interested in science as a kid, quite honestly, I did have that, background a little bit, being exposed to what scientists do for a living. Mm. I spent several summers working at Caltech just as a summer job to make some money, basically, not thinking that I would go into it as a profession, but mm-hmm. I turned out to be handy with a soldering iron, and so they put me to work on a gravity wave detector. Yeah. I'm not sure they've detected gravity waves yet, but I hope I did my part to get them partially there. And I also worked for a little bit, which actually made an impression on me looking back, in Leroy Hood's lab at Caltech, when I helped solder together a protein sequencers, some early, very early prototypes by disassembling Commodore 64 computers. And
so this was when Lee was beginning systems biology,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, very early days. This was in the 80s.
I remember doing filming a conversation with him.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. At the time I was there, though, it was more or less like a paycheck, and you know, the work environment was nice. But I found in college I got more and more interested in science and became deeply immersed in it maybe halfway through my undergrad years, and realizing that I had some ability to design experiments, to think about these things, how to measure things. And so I got very interested in physics and completed my degree in physics undergrad, and then I went on to graduate school at UCLA. And I did something a little interesting. I went and spent 4 years at Los Alamos National Labs in New Mexico in the physics division. And that was very interesting. They had that's a very, obviously, a very historic place. The division I was in was the cryogenics materials science division. And so they were, I think, the first to liquefy tritium, which was important strategically. And I developed some instruments there to perform NMR at extremely low temperatures near absolute zero. So we would go down to maybe 50 or 100 millikelvin. Magnetic resonance. So I spent my graduate years doing nuclear magnetic resonance, and we were measuring unconventional superconductors and some of the NMR properties of these materials. And that's, you know, very difficult experiments, I have to say. And it took me many years to get my experiments working. Once it's running, you basically take data nonstop for months at a time. So I always had a background in NMR. And then when I completed my degree, I spent a brief time out at IBM in Yorktown at the Watson Research Center doing NMR. And then I was hired at Caltech, and that's where I basically changed fields. And they have to give them credit, they have a great track record of retreading scientists. So having been trained in the physical sciences, I moved into the biological sciences, joined the biological sciences department, and worked at the Beckman Institute there. My mentor at the time was Scott Fraser. Mm-hmm. And so he understood the value that a physicist could bring to essentially a developmental biology lab. And so I went there and went through a period of not knowing what journals to read and sort of identity crisis and the like, because I couldn't think of a more, you know, it's a pretty harsh transition from physics to something like developmental biology, with physics being very quantitative and reductionist and developmental biology being very squishy and wordy, mm-hmm. the descriptions of phenomena. And so it was definitely a culture shock. But and so I spent my first couple of years just basically developing hardware. And the insights that they had at the time was that they would use MRI, again, as a tool to visualize basic biology. In this case, it was developmental biology, mm-hmm. and visualizing the cells and movements and the patterning of early embryonic development, but using super high-resolution MRI to accomplish this. And this sort of interests me, so I could bring my expertise that I had from NMR, applying it to biological problems. And so the early years were spent basically hardware development. And at the time, to do this very high-resolution MRI, a lot of the hardware didn't exist, and so we had to build it. So things like detection coils and preamplifiers and things like that. So drawing on my expertise with the soldering iron, I sat at the bench and did a lot of soldering.
Probably a little more complicated than that. But
yeah, well, and so we helped to acquire some very early data on embryos and looking at things like embryonic development in mouse and in Xenopus.
Toad.
Yeah, the African clawed frog.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, very cutting edge. Now, at that time, I also became interested in labeling cells in the context of looking at embryonic development, but but knowing that in the future that could be applied to mammalian systems and humans maybe. And so that's where my interest developed in cell tracking. And we had worked for a number of years with a chemist, Tom Mead, at Caltech, who was interested in visualizing gene expression with MRI. And so they were developing small molecule complexes that, when activated by beta-galactosidase, basically turned on the contrast agent within the cell and made it bright within the MRI image. So that was a very challenging and innovative time, but we were successful in getting that to work in a model system. It's one of the first papers to show that you could visualize gene expression with MRI. So this is now getting far away from the clinical use of MRI.
Yeah, and again, most people when you say MRI think of functional MRI, they think of the brain images that turn up in neuroscience papers, and there's been books about whether or not those images are too seductive for a general audience. And yeah, I mean, you've read that literature and so on and so forth. However, that aside, tracking and seeing what's actually going on in brain and other parts of the body is obviously something that helps a general audience get some sense of what's going on. When you're talking about stem cell therapies, and we were at dinner with Ann Tsukamoto the other evening, and you're talking about applications, it obviously helps an awful lot to know where the stem cells are going and what's going on. So we're straight into your domain, which is tracking things. But how do you start tracking things at this nanoscale as well? I mean, this is terribly small stuff. I mean,
yeah. So it's a great question. I mean, MRI doesn't have the ability to image at cellular resolution, right? So, I mean, we can get close. The instrument that we have here now at UCSD can track, can image at maybe 20 or 30 micron isotropic resolution, which is pretty high. You know, a cell is maybe 10 or 20 microns in diameter. But but that's still not good enough because you can't distinguish it from the neighboring cell. So you can't see single cells. You have to render them distinct in the magnets somehow. And the way we actually, way that people have done that is, there's several ways. Historically, people have put magnetic particles into the cell. So these are iron oxide nanoparticles. And what these particles do is in MRI, you look at mobile water and tissue, right? That's what you look at. You look at your water's full of mobile water. I mean, your body's full of mobile water. You probably know that. And you probably also know that the water has two hydrogens and an oxygen. If you don't know that, you probably wouldn't be sitting here. So in MRI, you
look... Is that why it's called H2O?
I think it might have something to do with it.
Okay, good.
But in MRI, we look at the hydrogen nucleus, right? The proton, okay? And when the proton is put in a magnetic field, it tends to line up along the field. So you have a big MRI magnet, has a strong magnetic field, it lines up. And you can then look at the precession of that nuclei. It processes around the magnetic field. And you can interrogate that nuclei about its position. And what the nuclei will report is basically what magnetic field it senses at its location. Now, if you put these magnetic particles inside of cells, you distort the magnetic field locally around the cell. And then there's water everywhere. The water molecules, or the protons, report on their magnetic field at their particular location. That's what they do. And they sense, aha, it's different now. And what that causes is a change in image contrast as a result. So you have a very expensive MRI magnet. It's expensive because it's very strong and homogeneous. What you've done now is locally disturb the magnetic field, make it poor, make it inhomogeneous. And then the nuclei report that to you, and it looks like a little bit of signal intensity change in that region. And that's how we can label cells with magnetic particles. And there's been a lot of work doing that. So that's one approach that people have been using to label cells and track them in the body. You have to you have to label them distinct somehow in the magnet. Approach that I've been sort of pioneering, working on over about the last 8 or 9 years, is to actually not look at the water, which is an indirect effect of the And its effect, as you see in the water, is indirect because of the magnetic particle. What we're looking at something is we look at directly. We put a tracer material in that we image directly. Mm-hmm. So in our approach, we've been putting in highly fluorinated molecules, perfluorocarbons, and we look at fluorine-19 MRI. Okay, so on the periodic table, you can see there's lots of atoms there, and some of them you can do MRI on. Not all of them, but maybe, I don't know, 50% of them or something like that. Fluorine is one. Mm-hmm. Fluorine-19 is 100% natural abundant. It's a stable isotope, fluorine-19. It turns out to have a lot of sensitivity in MRI. It's mm-hmm. fairly sensitive. So what we do is we electrically adjust our MRI machine to detect fluorine instead of proton. Okay. So we tune our resonance to fluorine, and then we can detect those labeled cells. We put the perfluorocarbon inside of cells, and then when those cells are put into the body, we detect them using fluorine-19 and alternate nucleus. Then we can also tune back to our proton and take the brilliant anatomy that MRI is known for, and then overlay those two data sets, and then you get the labeled cells in anatomical context. So that's a second way that people have been looking at cells in the body. There's some other ways, but those are the two main ways.
Okay, now, there's an overlap here, obviously, with, in April this year, the president announced the Brain Initiative. Francis Collins talked about it and so on. And one of the statements was that we already know a considerable amount about what's happening at the single cell level and on the macro scale with fMRI and so on and so forth. But what we don't understand is the activity of neurons in networks in that middle territory. So there's obviously lots of work to be done in terms of tracking those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, what we're learning more and more is that there is, for example, neuronal stem cells are constantly being created in the brain, and they're migrating out, reconstituting tissues, for example, in olfactory areas. And, so understanding the movements of those cells and whether we could, for example, redirect those movements to help brain repair is a very hot area, and I think MRI can play a role in watching those reparative cells go to work.
Right.
And certainly, if you're placing cells in the CNS to repair an injury of some sort or lesion, you can see again whether they're going to the right place, whether they're migrating, whether they're persisting, potentially whether they're differentiated or transformed in some way that's either good or bad. And so that I think that cell tracking can play a role in understanding how the brain works and how to repair the brain.
But here's a funny point that I just raised with Luke Lassen, you know, who's been using benztropin, which is a Parkinson's drug, mm-hmm. And it turns out to have a novel use in MS and helps at least stimulate a myelination process, remyelination process. So they're using existing pharmacological agents to make discoveries about what's going on in the system, and it's occurred to me that in all the discussions we've had in 10 years of stem cell conferences since CIRM started and so on, and because of the way the debate started to begin with, I still think, and I correct me if I'm wrong there, there's still a sense that the stem cells are things you have when you're young, and then they go then they go away because of all this debate about embryonic stem cells and so on and so forth, and the sense that there's a vast populations of stem cells that, if we knew more about them, could be put to new uses and could be stimulated to invigorating responses in as the organism ages. That's something that's sort of a new area that's kind of hadn't been thought about until quite recently. Am I wrong here?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, people are realizing that all tissues have pools of stem cells that can help renewal those particular organs and tissues. And, harvesting that regenerative power of those endogenous populations of cells is, one of the holy grails, I would think, in this field.
Yeah.
And then, a lot of it is, being able to see those cells, mm-hmm. where they are, and if they're... and if you want to, say, somehow stimulate their reparative response at a lesion, how do we know they're actually arriving at that site? And so I think that imaging can help with those sorts of questions.
Right, and as we have the debate a bit, certainly about the brain as well, this place being a neuronexus, as it is, with all the neuroscientists and the scientists, the engineers, the chemists, the partnerships with industry and so on and so forth. But it's clear that the scale of things is important here. Do we have, we apparently do not have the right technology yet for doing this kind of imaging. What are you thinking of as your soldering iron days come to the fore again? I mean, what kind of inventions need to be done here?
It's a great question. So, you know, if you talk to someone like, you know, someone who's leading a cell therapy trial to treat spinal cord or some, you know, hard disease like that, difficult disease to treat, you know, what they would like to be able to do is, let's say, okay, we can, you know, you can image where we inject the cells. That's nice. We can image, we have the technology now to image how many cells are put in that particular spot. And we're able to image them, you know, days and weeks later. But what they would always, the common request that people like that would have is, well, how do I know that a few rogue cells then leave the site of injection and go off to some other part of the body and wreak havoc,
yeah,
create a tumor or something like that? And that's a difficult question, because what you need to do then is figure out a way to image those cells and image those cells maybe months or years after they've been implanted, and have the sensitivity to detect very sparse numbers of cells, you know, hundreds maybe, and that's a tall order. And so, you know, honestly, the technology doesn't exist for something like that, you know, quite yet. And so, and the solution to that may not be MRI, quite honestly, because of the intrinsic sensitivity limitations of the technology. And that's just the basic physics. I mean, you have only so much signal to work with. Mm. So it might come from other technologies, either light-based or maybe radioisotope-based. And so that's, you know, something that, you know, is maybe 20 years away or 10 years, I don't know, put a time limit on it, but it's off in the future. But regardless of whatever technology gets developed, it's certainly going to be an interdisciplinary activity. And even in my work, to do cell tracking and do quantification and develop imaging methods that are tailored for detecting cells, it truly requires many different types of expertise. It requires, obviously, chemistry, maybe molecular biology, but then cell biology to characterize the effects of those reagents on cells. And then you need smart people to figure out how to write computer programs to tell the scanner what to do, how to acquire the data. You might need additional hardware modifications to your scanner. And then you might need post-processing or computational analysis of and data. So it really requires teams, and teams with a lot of bandwidth. And so that's just the nature of the business. So any solution will require input from all portions of campus, you know.
Well, even as when the Francis Collins, the NIH Directors Committee, reported in the last couple of weeks, and there was a telecon that we listened to, I mean, one of the things that was mentioned, the phrase was used, partsless. We don't even really know for the brain what all the parts are in terms of the types of neurons and so on. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge amount of exploration still to be done, which is exciting. Mm-hmm. But
mm-hmm. Imaging is going to definitely play a role, as you see. I mean, it's going to play a role not only in the functional analysis of, you know, the neural substrates of different activities, but also looking in great detail at the anatomy and trying to visualize the different locations where the specificity of populations of neurons and how those vary among different for conditions of like neuropsychiatric disorders and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's a really it's a great area, and so The brain is one region. I work on other things too. I basically am not, I'm agnostic with respect to body part. And, so I work from the head to toe. But a lot of the things that you'll learn for studying the gut may be important for studying the brain too. You know, some of the technologies that I'm working on. See, like cell tracking is pretty universal. And it can be applicable not only to the brain, but throughout the body, really.
So given your own interesting way to from there to here, I mean, what do you tell, what's your advice to a young scientist? What do you tell them to sort of think about, look for, how to comport themselves? I mean, what's the best?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. I would, you know, one thing that's always guided me a little bit is to take your ideas seriously, you know. If you get an idea about something and you think it's good, you should actually take it seriously and then act on that. And, you know, in my business, acting on it means, okay, maybe doing some preliminary data if you have the resources available, and writing a proposal, and, you know, maybe acquiring some more funding to do some more research. And, you know, it really just starts with an idea. And importantly, you need to take it seriously and act on it. And even though it may be very hard, you know, the goal may be very hard, if you think it's really a good idea, you should just go for it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so taking your ideas seriously is something that, you know, I think is essential to be, you know, successful in this business.
But then there are all these hurdles, aren't there? Like,
yeah.
There's friends of mine post on Facebook and they're deriding what they call the second reviewer, because the papers have to be reviewed and the first one gets through and it's fine, and then there's somebody says something really nasty, and then you discover that maybe there are competitors of yours, although they're supposed to be anonymous. In other words, there's all these little turns. There's lots of blocks in science as well. It's not straightforward. It's just an easy progression.
You know, I remember one thing my dad did help me with. He was a scientist. He gave me a book called, I forgot who the author was, but The Games That Scientists Play, or something to that effect. And I thought it was kind of funny. He gave it to me early on, but it actually made a big impression. I mean, it really is a game in some sense. I don't want to, you know, make it sound trivial, yeah. But in some sense, I do think it's a kind of a game where you have reviewers and things like that. You know, not that, but on the other hand, you get these comments back, and they were maybe confused by something. And it's not so much that there's anything wrong with them, it's that your burden's on you to explain it in a way that is not confusing to them. And so the burden is back on you, so they're giving you feedback, mm-hmm. whether you like it or not. And so I always try to take that their critiques and be constructive with it and say, you know, look, if this person was confused by this, someone else would be too, who was reading the paper. And so it's my job to make it more clear, to explain it more clearly, to understand, help them understand the significance and things like that. And so I try not to get too upset about things like that, emotionally attached to you know, particular writings that I've done or things like that. But take the critiques at heart and say, look, it was my failing. I didn't explain it well enough, and revise it. If you take that sort of that attitude that it's, you know, the burden's on you to convince them, then it takes a lot of the stress out of it. The other thing that I do... the other sort of philosophy that I take is that if, you know, there's a lot of areas in science where I would call bandwagon, people jump on and, you know, it's a big area, a lot of papers are being generated, you know, funding is good in a particular area. I try to avoid those areas altogether and go off on my own. Again, you get back to, I get an idea, maybe it's orthogonal to what other people are doing, take it seriously and go with it. And avoid the what most people are doing. So if a lot of people are into an area, I'll go off to do something else.
And, okay, so you don't like Me Too areas.
No, I try to avoid it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I consciously do that.
So what would you say is the best idea you've had?
Well, that's a tough question.
There's something you can look back on and so you think, that was pretty good idea.
I won't answer that in terms of a scientific idea, but I'll just say in terms of career choice, basically leaving physics. You know, it's traditional physics, although you always carry, you know, that sort of mindset with you everywhere. But but sort of going into a path that was emerging. I saw as emerging, which was biological imaging and using, for example, MRI to look at biology. I saw it as an emerging area, and virtually no one was doing it, very few. So I thought that was an emerging area, and so I went for that. And that was, I think, a good choice. Mm-hmm. And it's allowed me to have a an enhanced career, I would say, over what I would be experiencing if I stuck with conventional solid-state physics or something like that, which is, I mean, a fantastic field, not to put it down or anything, but I think it, for me personally, was a good choice to do something a little bit more, less evolved. Mm.
Actually, being at Caltech in the 80s, I mean, you Feynman was still there.
Yeah, yeah,
Murray Gell-Mann was still there. John Allman was in biology. I suppose Christoph Koch was there by then.
Oh, yeah.
Gilles Laurent.
Yep.
Just starting out. So these are people who are now running institutes. Mm-hmm. Christoph is off at the Alan Brain Observatory Institute. Gilles Laurent, I think, runs a Max Planck, does his great work on olfactions. Mm-hmm. John Allman, of course, you know. So there was a shift, I suppose, in Caltech's history from the beginning, from being highly engineering in physics the biology became quite powerful over those years as well, I think. So, mm-hmm. So was that generating your shift, do you think, the shift in ideas?
In retrospect, it probably did change my thinking a little bit. Historically, that institution was very physics-oriented.
Yeah.
Physics and chemistry oriented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a few pillars like Feynman and Pauling.
You know, Linus.
And so the fact that they were seeing that that's where the future is, the future is, I think that maybe had some impact on me, that maybe I should consider steering that direction. I think it maybe did influence me a little bit, sure.
Yeah.
And the notion that, and they also have a track record of, you know, retooling the physical scientists to do biology. They have a good track record of that. There's been successful faculty there that have done that. So that all influenced me, certainly.
So did you ever consider doing anything else? I mean, is there ever another career that might have appealed to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think early on I thought about... I was interested in history. In high school, I was interested in other things other than science, quite honestly. I was very interested in music. I was very interested in history. And I considered alternate paths that were very different than science. I think early in my studies, I thought about going into business, which is not unusual for an American, right? certainly. And I found that I was sort of good at this. I don't know why particularly. It's not something that I always aspired to be a scientist. That's not the case at all.
Right.
In fact, there may be some, almost the opposite. But I found that I could do this and think about it in a way that was...
Do you read much history of science as well? Because one of the things I've found is that gets lost, because science is always moving forward, it's the latest thing, you read the latest, you know, papers from the latest journal as you're a student and so on, and this great, wonderful history and philosophy of science is often not given quite so much play, but when you start telling students those kind of stories, they're usually spellbound by them.
I went through a period where I was fascinated by that and, you know, read all the books and things about the history of science. I was very interested in the history of atomic energy, for example, and the history of, large scientific projects, physics-based projects, for example, and history of the genome and things like that. So these large projects, these large programmatic scientific efforts were interesting to me. I went through a period where I was very, very interested in that.
Sure. Los Alamos, of course.
It's a fascinating history. So when I was there, I was intrigued by the whole history of that place. And then having to be able to meet some of these great people that impacted that history, like Edward Teller. I remember having dinner with him one night, which is fascinating, at someone's house. And having, sitting with him for, half an hour, just chatting with him, you know, as being a kid or maybe in my 20s, sitting next to this guy, you know, you struggle for conversation a little bit, but, you know, I managed to have an interesting conversation with him. That's a fascinating place, and I was, you know, felt happy to be there.
I assume you didn't talk too much about Robert Oppenheimer, though.
No, I didn't bring him up. He told me a few jokes that Ronald Reagan told him, and I'm sure when Ronald Reagan told the joke, it was hilarious, but when he told it, it wasn't so good. Better stick with physics.
So interestingly, again, those connections, the people working on the bomb, I'm thinking about Leo Szilard. Leo Szilard goes to General Atomics. General Atomics is here. Mm-hmm. Jonas Salk is looking for somewhere to live after he makes the polio vaccine discovery. Talk to Robert Oppenheimer, actually, about what to do. And Robert Oppenheimer apparently said you should set up an independent institute. Mm-hmm. Jonas, by all accounts, from Suzanne Bourgeois' new history of the Salk Institute, genesis of the Salk Institute, Leo phoned up and said, this place in La Jolla, you should come and look. And now it has the stem cell meeting on the Mesa in it. So I was just doing a little journey there. It's sort of very interesting how these projects take. Now, when you talk about large projects, of course, the latest grand challenge is the Brain Initiative. Mm-hmm. How do you view that? I mean, what did you think when it was announced?
Anything like that is good, just in general terms. That's a good thing that they're focusing, you know, energies and monies on science as opposed to other things. I think that's good. So, the brain, I think, is a safe topic. It's an unexplored area. There's certainly, the neuroscience industry has, you know, just grown tremendously over the years. And so it's a good way to direct those, the focus, those energies. And so
so if you go back to the history of science again, or let me give you a kind of, what may be a historical question, I'm not sure, but suppose I gave you a time travel token. Mm-hmm. And said you could bring to your dinner table anybody from any period, mm-hmm. any discipline, and sit down and have some conversation with them. Anybody you'd like to talk to, have questions? You've already done Edward Teller, so that's...
Well, that was an interesting one. Let me think about that. That's a good, great question. I've always been intrigued by these early scientists in the golden age of physics, and... some of these great minds like Heisenberg and Pauli and some of these guys. So Dirac may be an interesting guy to talk to, although he wasn't very
vocal. Doesn't sound like he was very interesting to talk to.
But just to see the personality. So some of these physicists from the golden age of physics would be interesting. Yeah. You know, when they're just developing quantum mechanics.
Well, that photograph of the 1927 Solvay conference is spectacular, although I think I read an article recently that pointed out that Marie Curie was the only woman in there.
Yeah, certainly some guy like Albert Einstein would be fascinating to talk to.
If
only I spoke German, we'd have a better conversation. But
Heisenberg, of course, there you have another of those shifts. His book, What is Life? Mm-hmm. is supposed to have been an impetus for many of the people who were working on physics, particularly during the wartime, to then shift into biology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's one of the episodes that Craig Venter talks about in his forthcoming book. He actually went to Trinity College Dublin recently and gave some lectures and referenced again the Heisenberg book and how it had been a big shift for people. So it's sort of interesting how that all...
I mean, those old-timers would make interesting dinner conversation for sure.
What do you think? You've mentioned 10 or 20 years, possibly. I mean, I know it was a speculative answer in terms of getting the kind of devices that might be needed for doing this kind of exploratory tracking.
We have these tools today and to do tracking, to get the type of resolution that would be the ultimate. We're talking about you know, single cells or tens or hundreds of cells to track those in the body. That's still not really here yet in the human body, okay?
Right.
But we do have lots of things that can track cells of larger numbers today. And those are very new. Some of those things are new, okay? And so the full, they haven't been fully exposed or exploited. And so that's sort of what I'm going to be spending the next few years doing.
Yeah.
So if you want to track, say, the delivery of cells, the migration of cells, where the cell numbers are like 100,000, something like that, we have those technologies today. And you can address very important critical questions with that, with what we have at hand. Mm-hmm. I do believe that. It's just a matter of application, implementation. And so that's what I'm going to be focused on in the next few years.
Rightful place of science in society. What is that? It's a phrase that was used by President Obama when he first came into office.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of discussion about that in the news. I think that people need to appreciate that, you know, America is where it is today because of science, in great part, the scientific innovation. So I think it's absolutely critical to the future of the country, you know, sustained investment in this area. And to say otherwise, I think, is naive about history. And you need to realize that industries, huge industries, are created from investments in basic science and a sustained investments that only, for example, the federal government can provide, that companies don't have the intestinal fortitude to sustain investment in certain areas. And so government has to step in, take a long-term view. And that's what governments are good at. Mm. So I think that, at least in the U.S., that sustained investment in science is just critical for us, for our survival even. And that's historically, that's been shown to be true. I think our success has been fueled by scientific innovation. I think that's undeniable. So,
So where do you see, where do you see this field of yours going? I mean, what's the next step?
In terms of cell tracking, I believe that, well, we had this conference here this week, and we see that we're just approaching, I believe, maybe a golden era of cellular therapies. I mean, we had small molecules, recombinant proteins, and now cell-based therapies are the next wave of therapeutics, and this is, you know, appreciated by many. And I believe that cell tracking will play initially an integral role in that to accelerate clinical trials to help overcome regulatory barriers by helping to understand where the cells go, and so that we're going to get away from a mindset of I have magic cells, see them work, to here are my cells, this is where they go, this is why they have reparative properties or curative mm-hmm. properties. And so that's going to be enabled by seeing those cells, visualizing them. Now, when those cell tracking experiments are integrated into clinical trials, when some of those therapies, not all of them, some of them will be hopefully approved and reimbursed, that cell tracking will be part of the label. And so that every time those cells, a particular type for a particular disease, are delivered to a patient, they require imaging to verify that they were delivered correctly and to follow up to see that there was no adverse effects or migration of those cells. So I think that in certain cases, imaging will be integrated into the label, the approval of these therapeutics. And there is precedent for that. For example, when you put a stent into your body, you use fluoroscopy to position that, and that's an imaging modality. And the approval of that stent on the label has imaging as part of it, a required part of it.
One of the things that occurs to me as I sit and watch these meetings and so on is that people are, you know, they've got their Sunday best slides and everything, and the story makes totally coherent sense and so on and so forth. That's obviously how you should present the information. But the stage of the work that took to get there is often fraught with dead ends and all sorts of stuff. And you end up, because of the way science is and the way its final results are communicated to a public, with the public thinking that scientists are in the certainty business. It's all certitudes. You don't have to have read Karl Popper and know about falsifiability hypotheses and so on. You get the sense that it's in the certitude business. And I often like to play devil's advocate and say, well, actually, it's in the doubt business. Because you inches forward and then... do you know what I'm getting at here?
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Have you? Can you recall periods in your development when you thought, this is...
Oh, yeah, all the time.
I'm going the wrong way with this. I mean, what...
Oh, sure. I mean... My view of this is like, you know, ideas are kind of a dime a dozen. What you can do, I have all these great tools in my lab. I mean, these MRI machines, these cells, these viruses, all these different fun things. You can go and play with them in all different ways.
Yeah.
The name of the game here is to figure out what not to do, how not to spend your time, okay? And, you know, so there's some of that is, you know, just in your mind. You say you do mental experiments and thinking, oh, this is not going to be successful. But also when you start to get some preliminary data, knowing when to... you know, cut it off and punt, basically. Let's quit doing that. So I do that all the time. Hit dead ends all the time. But it's better to have the insight to know, you know, to cut it sooner rather than later, not repeat the same failed experiment over and over. Hmm. And so I try to avoid that. So, yeah, I mean, it's research. It's not certainty. So it's you're going to have dead ends in the nature of the business, but the name of the game is that knowing when to cut it sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
And having the insight to know, you know, this is a failed experiment, therefore we're not going to repeat it again and again because we'll get the same outcome.
Okay, we'll put that in the same folder as advice to a young scientist.
Very good.
An additional point. Okay, last question. What are you optimistic about?
Lots. I mean, I'm optimistic. Well, that's a tough question. Let me see. I'm optimistic about lots of things. You know, in my own research, I'm optimistic that... we're going to see cell tracking going to be adopted, not universally, but widely, let's say. Mm. And so I'm fairly optimistic about that. I am optimistic about that. And it's going to, a lot of people are going to go kicking and screaming toward that. But I think that the results will be so compelling that they can't hide. They can't avoid it. Mm. So I'm optimistic about certainly imaging. The field of imaging and its increased importance as we develop more sophisticated probes to read out more sophisticated biological information. Mm-hmm. Those type of endeavors will be integrated more and more into scientific endeavors. And so.
Good. I wish you well in your endeavors.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Eric Aaron's great to talk to you. Thanks very much.